right. We're going to start. Of stuff to get going on. Everybody, I sent the notes, which thank God I don't know what I'd do without Joe. Taking notes on the last meeting. Hey, Eric, back in earlier May.
Yep.
Okay. And then we had the public input night. And I and Deb went through this, and Joe took really good notes. And I think we got the names pretty correct as much as possible.
I didn't, but I didn't
Judge.
Know or not. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
But you got it, Terry.
Then do you want me to hand out what I...
Yep, hang on.
You have to wait your turn.
There's
I know.
Did everybody get a copy? I'll keep extras because I'm sure people will want them. Pat, can you pass them out? Thank you.
Should we leave one in this chair just in case someone sits in this chair?
Here. And I got more. Okay. So there were two things that I thought we kind of needed to touch upon tonight, and you can decide which order you want to take them in. We had already done the first half up to plea or conviction. And I think the second half of that, the plea or conviction, trial, whatever, on, you know, through to sentencing, I think is going to go a lot quicker than the first half did. And I don't know the ramifications of that process or the specifics of it, but we can do that, and then we need to talk about starting to compile things that we learned at the public input night, things we've talked about. Pat had a good suggestion about short-term, you know, immediate stuff to implement or long-term, and Deb actually broke some of the things out. It's not a complete list, but it's got a lot of stuff in it, and she broke it out by...
areas of need, basically.
Yes.
What I heard from the public input, it doesn't include everything we talked about up to here. It was just today going through those minutes, highlighting some of the things that the public talked about and that we've talked about briefly here. But
by, like, subject area.
By subject area.
But however you all want to do it is fine. And whichever one you want to do first is fine. I think I'm kind of inclined to, this is just my thought, chime in, just to finish that process and get that done. Because I think once we start digging into the suggestions, that's going to take us through as we look at, okay,
yeah,
long-term, short-term, what do we want to look at? You know, and start doing like a cost-benefit feasibility. So I think we might as well do the process, get that done, so we know what we're talking about.
Who's doing the process?
Our judge.
So I missed the...
Oh, Eric has a question, Susan.
Eric, sorry.
There's a couple of things that I'd be interested in knowing more about. I'm not quite sure how it fits into what you just sketched. First and foremost, I would be very interested in hearing the district attorney come in and talk about the kinds of things that we've been discussing with various other players and getting a take on how her office perceives the kinds of choices that we're talking about. Secondly, I gather that someone, I'm not even clear who, has recently gotten funding for the Defender-Based Advocacy Program.
That's the assigned counsel program.
That's about as much as I know.
Right.
And I'd be interested in knowing more about what's actually going to be happening and what that would mean. And thirdly, we've heard little fragments that it's now going to be required that attorneys be present at initial arraignment.
Right.
But there again, it feels more like a rumor than a real report on exactly what the new story is, and I'd be interested in hearing.
I can
maybe
that's
just
talking
to me. I'd like to hear very specifically.
I think that those are all good questions, and I know that Judge Riley, Deb, and Joe are very versed in those things that are going on. I had asked when to be here or send somebody, and I'm hoping to have a DA presence because I think as we go forward, we need one.
And one other thing. Joe and I have been going back and forth by email with some statistical analysis stuff, and I would be happy if you could give me a few minutes of agenda time to at least summarize where we've gotten to and where we haven't.
You want to do that now?
If you want.
Go for it.
Okay. I don't have this all rehearsed. Let's see.
Those
Number
are the best.
One, Joe gave me data from which it was possible to try and figure out for pre-trial are there significant variations in jail population by day of the week? And again, this is only for pretrial and not for sentenced prisoners, but the answer was that between the days of the week, there is negligible difference through the 7 days. It's like a 2% variation in terms of the average over the long run.
In what? In
jail population?
In jail population?
In jail population. But it was interesting that in terms of jail, if we track by days of the week, jail intakes and jail releases, there are big differences, which were not quite what I expected. That it's very, both intakes and releases are very low on the weekend, and it starts medium on Monday, goes up Tuesday, up again on Wednesday to the peak, and then falls off again Thursday and Friday. The peak day for intakes and releases is Wednesday. Maybe that's just an artifact of when the local courts
City court meets on Wednesday, and
okay.
That's why.
Okay, yep. And that might well be it. Secondly, again, Joe gave me data just for pretrial. Yeah. And trying to break it out, but I was wishing for data by judge, but all we've got thus far is data by court. How much jail time each court is responsible for. And then I could plug in census data and say per capita for each jurisdiction, how much jail time is each court responsible for.
Wait, don't you need to include the crime rate?
I wish I could. If someone is able to give me good crime rate statistics, I'd be happy to have them, but last I heard is that there's no such thing.
I think the only one that's got that is Gwen, right?
Because she might, but I mean, otherwise I think we can get a pretty historic picture if you could come out and say Cuba Heights. I mean, you've got to look at the crime rate.
I wish I could. If give me the data, and I'll see what I can find. But in any event, I found there's a lot of stuff that I didn't analyze. So just a quick pass, sent Joe an email with a summary, and now the ball's in his court. Haha. Two things. One is that we had numbers from the State Division of Criminal Justice Services on average pretrial trial population for the year. And we had numbers from Joe's database, I'm not sure where the original source of that is, indicating number of persons pretrial by broken out by charge. And the numbers from the two sources don't match each other at all. The numbers from Division of Criminal Justice Service are roughly double what you get if you add up the numbers.
Because the numbers we're working with are just jail population. The numbers DCJS is working with would be all arrestees,
no,
right?
No. It was DCJS
just jail population.
Jail population.
And they're apples and oranges. It's goofy.
Well,
now, maybe there's a good explanation,
and when
but
you
I
say pre-trial, Eric, you must mean unsentenced.
Correct.
Which is not just pre-trial, but post-trial before sentencing.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how DCJS breaks it down.
Even so, the numbers, when we add up the local numbers, they come to about 50% of what the DCJS numbers are for each of 3 years.
DCJS.
What's DJ?
Criminal Justice Service.
And where's that?
This is still work in progress. I don't want to as finished news, but at least it was very, very puzzling. So the other thing that jumped out at me was that if we just do number of unsentenced jail days by court, not surprisingly, city court and county court have significantly more than most all of the smaller jurisdiction courts, with the major exception of Town of Dryden,
which gets a lot of business.
Which gets a lot, and particularly the one thing that I happen to notice is that in the course of a 3-year period, countywide, 34 people were sentenced to some kind of jail time for DWI first offense. Mm-hmm. And 3/4 of those were from Dryden.
Right.
So again, I'm not sure what that means.
Means the personality of the judge.
Yeah, 2/3 of those are one judge.
That's entirely possible, but I don't have information to tell me that. I just saw what the numbers are. Something different is going on in Dryden. But that just reinforces my general impression that judges are pivotal And my wish is that not just this committee, but in an ongoing way, that the ATI board will routinely pay more attention to the town and village agendas.
Well, I don't know how to respond to that, but I would say it would be completely inappropriate to, if there was one judge who was responsible for most of that, to contact that judge and say, hey, you know what, you stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, I think he's very aware of what his legal responsibilities are. He's very aware of what his options are, and he's using his judgment. I don't think there should be feedback to him that questions his judgment.
I wasn't saying that.
No. Well, I don't know how you give him that information without suggesting that it's questioning his judgment.
Through the electoral process, wouldn't you think, Judge?
Well,
that wasn't what I was saying either.
But I will say that I think that's how you...
What I was thinking more of is what I wish for, and I think that time constraints may not make it possible for this time-limited committee. But what I wish is that there just be routine, if only annual, contact with each of the judges, asking questions like, how can we help you do your job better? What tools do you wish you had that you don't have that might enable you to use alternatives more effectively? And exactly what those questions need to be is something that would have to be hashed out.
Pat can respond
I'd like there to be more of that kind of contact.
Pat can respond to that, and then I'll say something to Eric.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, any new judge who's elected, I meet with personally. Mm-hmm. And I come to the office and I review how we interface, how we communicate with each other, what they should expect from probation, and review our ATIs. So mm-hmm. they have very good working knowledge. I also routinely ask to do training. And I actually had a training set up for last October, but we couldn't get the judges to come. Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult to kind of corral them and get them to come to a training address.
I'm thinking more of one-on-one contact.
Mm-hmm. What kind of training?
Going to them.
Oh, it was going to be training on DWI, our risk and needs assessment, and what that means, and how we use it, the supervision, the sentencing recommendations, transfer out cases, interstate transfers, that kind of stuff. Electronic monitoring, I think, was on the agenda.
And when you talk to about ATIs, do they get a list of the services?
You know, I could say that an aspect of what probation has to offer is that they do have data about judges' choices quite specifically, because they track the recommendations they make to courts and the court's response to that recommendation. And just to be... I'm just very protective of the judge's realm. I mean, I might disagree completely, 100%, or I might agree completely. Either way, I don't want to tread into that area, so I just want to be careful about it. But it was very useful to me to sit down with the director of probation and her say, you know, I mean, because I said, look, I'd like to hear it. You know, tell me what data you have about me. And there was not a concern. It was just a fact that it appeared that I was deviating from probation recommendations. It basically was that high-risk people, that I was putting high-risk people in the community when they were recommending they not come in the community. In the end, it turned to be an artifact or some kind of confusion in the data. But it's very interesting. And I said, in fact, I'd like to see some of the cases so we can sit down and review some of them, because I think judges can learn from that kind of feedback. So I appreciate the point, Eric. I think that we could come up with a way, especially to judges who are interested, who you could give them very specific. I mean, you could say to a judge, well, if you really want to know, you appear to be the only one who has a policy or a preference or a behavior where you seem to routinely sentence first-time DWI offenders to incarceration. Actually, the next question I would ask is, I wonder how many of those folks end up with felony DWIs compared to the rest of us who give them straight probation, and they don't get any of that, you know. And so I don't have an opinion on whether it's good or bad, but there may well be, in fact, I would say there is a useful process there. They're very time-consuming. If you're talking about old Pat sitting down with these one-by-one or a small committee doing it, but there are some judges who I think would benefit from it and would be very eager to participate in it if we presented it the right way.
We're hoping to get information from you, not we're here to lecture you.
Right. And that's not anything new. to CJATI, Aaron. That's something that we've been working on for a long time. And, you know, part of it is we put effort forward and we have to figure out what can we control, what can we not. And there are some things we can't control. But educating and that ultimate question, which is why Mark Dresser's on CJATI, he's our magistrate representative.
Right.
And it's very, you know, hard to get people together, you know, to sit and brainstorm on stuff. But one of the things that has been asked before is, okay, so perhaps, you know, you sentenced this person to jail. What would you have liked to have seen put in place that might have steered him somewhere else?
Exactly.
And we can go in that direction, and we've tried, and we'll continue to try. But
I mean, I might word it as a recommendation being ongoing engagement of
yes.
judges, county village,
yeah.
et cetera, in the alternatives and
yeah.
the decision-making process that they're responsible for.
Yeah.
You know, ongoing, because, you know, we need it. That's what you're
yeah.
trying
and
to
it, and
fit,
it's,
but, it, you know, we can do better with it.
Judge, yeah. do those magistrates commune among themselves, or are they
well,
sort of like
historically, it's been up and down. There used to be more regular connection. It's harder to do. Then for a while we were having some luck because they needed CLEs and we could bring them together with CLEs. And
CLEs,
continuing legal ed.
Continuing legal education, just their routine requirements that they have to get. But then they started making them available to them online. And so it takes an effort. I mean, as Pat said, we did a very solid proposal. But, you know, I would say it'd be better to get a third of them together than to get none of them together. So that even if we didn't have a great turnout, if we're trying to, or as Eric said, it may be that you just go one by one, and over the course of a year, you know, two or three people have sat down with, you know, 90% of them by persistence. And, you know, it's not like even, you know, once a year or once every couple of years, you get a lot of bang for your buck, I think, out of that, of sitting down. Really,
the very close one to get
yeah.
yeah. Let me respond to a couple of the other things that you were saying, just so we can knock those off the list. Because it also does relate. There was a, I think, Joe, you were at the meeting. It was a difficult meeting recently, but it's connected with your the question about the arraignment. So this is the process that's now in place for all of Tompkins County. When a town or village judge is contacted for an arraignment outside of normal business hours, so you know, whatever, some of the courts have evening courts. I presume it's after 9 p.m. or whatever, that there is on, so the routine is police call a town or village judge, say we've got a defendant that needs to be arraigned. That's because, as we know, the sheriff's department doesn't have the discretion to issue an appearance ticket, whereas the city police does. The state police, I don't know what they have to do, but it's a situation where a judge has to see the defendant. Either it's DV or it's some other requirement, or it's their own judgment that this case is serious enough. So if it's 1 o'clock in the morning, what the judge is required to do is then say, all right, well, I'll meet you down at the courthouse, or, well, that's what it's supposed to be, all courthouse now. It used to be at their house. The courthouse at one, you know, meets you there at 1:30 in the morning. When the judge gets there, the judge is supposed to get one page, you know, a quick checklist that defendant to see if they appear to be eligible for assigned counsel. If they appear to be eligible for assigned counsel, probably 90% of them are going to be. Then the judge is required to call the attorney on call. Attorney on call now 24/7, essentially 365. That's the plan. And so that attorney on call, lifer, and so now, you know, Jason's not getting a call till 1:30 unless the judge happens to say, you know, I'm going to preemptively call or recognize the name or whatever. And maybe 1:30 when he calls, Jason, I got a hot one for you. What can he be here? As well, you know, let me get out of my pajamas. You know, I'll be there by 2. I'll be there 10 of 2, whatever it is. So it takes longer. But that is now the mandate in Tompkins County. Now, but if they don't otherwise appear to be eligible or they don't request an assigned attorney, there's no basis for the judge to do that. And they'll just do an arraignment without counsel.
Whose mandate is that?
This start with the Court of Appeals.
Didn't that come from?
Start with the Court of Appeals, and then it became the policy of the court system. And then they made available this money to prime the pump, and then eventually the county's just going to foot the bill, but they're trying to get a sense of how big a problem it is. And Joe can fill in the details because he knows a lot more about the specifics. But the point I wanted to make was that in having the conversation with the town and village judges about this, there was not a lot of joy in what that there appeared to be at least some local judges with very resistant to the extra time, the extra effort, the hassle of doing this. Some people got very angry with judges kind of losing sight of the purpose of the criminal justice system and the protection of rights and the idea why, and besides the fact that it's now a mandate, they don't really have a choice. So I just say that to say that there is some unhappiness among Tonto Village judges in Tompkins County, and beyond that, actually, if you want to look at the current state of affairs with Tonto Village judges, the SAFE Act has put people over the edge. I don't know how many of them are over the edge in Tompkins County, but in Western New York and Northern New York, the requirements about seizure of guns and all the rest, judges are in outright rebellion, refusing to enforce the law, refusing to seize guns, and it's a really bad situation. So the level of cooperation right now is probably at a low, which is not a good thing. On the other hand, I think that the mandate for the arraignments, I think we are going to see good results as a result of that. Joe, is there any big things that I missed?
Just a little nuanced point. This was coming. This one got a little in front of me. It sounded as if there was a new state mandate that was imposed on every county to do this. In fact, we got in front of the mandate that's probably going to happen soon. And our assigned counsel program secured a grant, a three-year grant, to pay for the additional cost of counsel of first appearance. I think we may be the first county in the state to do this on a county-wide basis. So in terms of what we can talk to the community about, in terms of what we are doing kind of all the time to improve the situation, this puts us out, I believe, in front of the rest of the state. And I know that Judge Malby was very clear in saying this is the way it's going to be. And from this point forward, there will be a lawyer at first appearance. We've heard Mark Dresser talk about how important that will be at the town level to expedite the process. So if there's additional time spent that night, there might be less time for that follow-up hearing that has arraignment with counsel that occurs. So it might be actually some time savings as things progress.
I definitely think this is an efficiency thing for several reasons. You've also got an attorney now who's going to take that case. This is another attorney are assigned. So they're already in it from the beginning. They don't have to start from scratch with them. The only other thing I wanted to add was that Judge Malby did send out a memorandum cautioning the Town and Village judges about making public statements like, you wake me up at night, they're going to spend the night in jail. Those kinds of sentiments are inappropriate, and they're, in fact, subject to discipline if you make this publicly. So, he has taken a strong position on all of this.
Is the DA's office also going to have a representative in the middle
of the night? No, and I think that's a big part of the problem. What's required is that on a felony, the judge has to talk with has to give the ADA, a DA, an opportunity to be heard on bail. So they usually just call them and say, look, I'm looking at a robbery second, here's the name, what do you think? And they roll over and say, 5 and 10. I don't think it's a very involved process. I mean, if it's a big deal, someone's going to roll out of bed and come out there, but I think that's a fairly routine thing. As far as I know, did you have any discussion about that, Joe, at all? That there's no requirement for it? And Jason, do you have any sense of that?
No, other than the felony. I don't know what.
Have you done any of these yet?
No, I haven't. I mean, I got one call, but they went down the list so quick. By the time I called back, no one picked up the phone. it was right at the beginning of
it got more settled.
Right, and I think the way we're going to do it, as far as attorneys go, we're going to have one attorney assigned for a particular 24-hour period.
Right. That's what Julia said. And to your point, Eric, Julia Hughes is somebody we should invite to come and talk and answer any questions you have about those variety of issues.
Yeah.
And Julia's been, talking at CJATI, and maybe this is something we can put on the upcoming agenda in a couple weeks, because most of the people here are on CJATI and the four public people. We would love to have you come, because there's information going back and forth all the time. We're trying to not have people have to come double duty as much as possible.
When is that next meeting?
26th of June.
Yep, June 26th. Yeah. And that's over in our regular room.
Again, please?
Noon, June 26th.
I mean, Judge Chris Colosi is done.
What day of the week is that?
It's a Wednesday.
Okay. So it's the fourth Wednesday of the month, Eric.
Yeah, that's a hard time for me.
Judge Chris Colosi and Mayor Sack have done a couple, and they've done a few of these at night, off hours. And then I know Jerry and I did a recent felony, but it was during business hours.
Yeah. I mean, what George just said, that they've been refining how they're doing it, going to that one. And in fact, we're using it in county court. The only place that this happens in county court is when someone gets picked up overnight on a warrant. They don't have a felony warrant. They don't have to be seen by a judge. They can be taken to jail directly. Right. First thing in the morning, we get a call saying we've got somebody who needs to be arraigned in front of you. We'll do kind of a courtesy attempt to get their past attorney or any attorney we know who's been involved, but they haven't been seen. But the same thing with a violation of probation when that gets filed, and if there's a warrant on it, they get picked up. Same thing, even their initial appearance. So we're going to, those are the only times we see defendants in court without lawyers. So we're going to get the same list and use the same process. If the prior attorney doesn't say, I'm available, or doesn't answer the phone, or says, I'm not taking the case anymore, we'll call that. So both Judge Cassidy and I have already started that policy.
Okay. As far as data issues, Eric, you and Joe keep working on it. We're going to plug that. All right. Judge, do you want to walk us through the process?
So what are we looking at for? Where there's opportunities for release, or what are they?
We were trying to first understand points? The process and where the jumping on points
were. And how far did you get the first
So
time?
We got up to
up to
trial or plea. So now we want, like, they're going to enter a plea or it's going to go to trial, and then from there on. And I think this will be much shorter than, you know, the ones we sat on.
Sure. Just trying to combine, you know, all the different kinds of courts and the same kind of things. If we're talking about, let's just take a plea, for example. So the attorneys handle these things between themselves and the district attorney. There probably is a prospect for things moving a little faster in some cases. Sometimes it's just a matter of the lawyers and the DA sitting down, talking, getting through the material so they can make lawyers can make an accurate assessment of the case, get the case scheduled for an appearance. Sometimes it's that plea that then does allow someone to get out of jail. There may be a time served with it, or there may be a release pending pre-sentence investigation report. And else it works the other way around. The person may be in the community, and the plea may, usually the plea doesn't mark the time they start jail time. Usually it's sentencing. But it can. So we've got people who are in jail awaiting a resolution. One place that would be interesting to talk to Gwen about this. One place that does bog down is on the Superior Court information. And Jason, you probably have some experience with this.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to get into detail about it, but if the person's in jail on a felony and there's a plea agreement, they can bypass grand jury and consent to a plea in county court, but there's some extra paperwork that has to be done and an extra procedure. And it sometimes it seems to take 3 or 4 weeks for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite sure why it takes so long for it to happen. That doesn't necessarily mean that a person in jail is going to get out because they had a plea, but it could. In some cases it will. And in any event, it takes the plea before you go to a sentencing. So at the time of the plea, most of these cases, certainly any felony and any time significant jail time is on the table. And in fact, any time probation is likely to be recommended. Probation department would prefer that we order a pre-sentence investigation report. That's the report that Pat's staff do. And they do real reports with real substance, reviewing real records. And these are important documents that have a big impact on where the case goes. And so it takes time. So we're talking 5 or 6 weeks. But if the plea in county court happened, you know, 2 weeks earlier, then that sentence date would be 5 or 6 weeks after that. So if that's the point where they're going to be released, then that could happen a little sooner, too. But I just kind of thinking out loud about where there might be some places that we could have some impact. The for the most part, judges don't have a big impact on those plea negotiations, except for, and this again might be preference of judges, but you could sit down and talk to judges about saying, you know, if you are willing to conference a case with the attorneys, they may be more willing to enter guilty pleas or resolve cases sooner because you've committed to a sentence. And some judges, by their nature, would prefer not to have that conversation. It's sort of a way to, you know, hide the cards, though. It's sort of like, you know, go ahead, plead to anything. You know, I'm not making a commitment. You know, there are cases where I do that, but in general, where I can facilitate a plea, it'll help if Jason comes in with the DA and they come in and say, look, you know, listen, this wouldn't happen in front of me very often, but this is a misdemeanor case, and the DA's asking for a year. Judge, what are you likely to do? And if I have enough information, I'll say, look, I think a year's appropriate, or I think 9 months is enough, or I'll cap it at 6 months, those kind of things. Or I'll say it won't be any greater than what probation recommends. There's all sorts of ways to do that. There may be, and I don't know if you have a sense, Jason, you feel like 100% of judges in Tompkins County now are going to respond to a request to have a conversation about that, or there's some that you're not, you don't feel
like. You mean
like,
about sentencing?
Yeah. They're going to make a commitment on sentencing.
There are some I know who won't make a commitment at all. And they'll mostly just listen to probation. And when it comes down to others, wouldn't we make, you know, there's some way I go, you know, I feel like I'm making a sentencing argument that it just goes over.
Yeah, so maybe a training issue. Again, it's a personality style. But I feel like if you understand it well enough, you can always say, look, I'm going to promise no greater than 6 months as long as there's nothing in the probation report that's unexpected. Or as long as you are honest and open and answer the questions completely with probation. You come back and they say, no, I didn't do that. You know, I only did it because I was forced to. And I say, look, you know, that's unacceptable. That violates what I said. And then you can proceed to sentence them. So there is some training issues there.
Yeah.
So if I can try to go back to the flow over again. So if you enter a plea, Pat, you know the rules better than I do. How much jail time can they get without a PSI now?
6 months.
Six months. So they can on the spot enter a guilty plea and get up to 6 months without any requirement to get a probation report. If there's going to be, even at your point, your preference is, at this point, your preference would be even on a B misdemeanor or a year's of probation, it would still want a report.
If the court is contemplating probation, we want a report.
Yeah. Just makes sense so they know who's coming in the door.
We can establish the conditions, meet the needs of the person.
Do most courts follow that?
Not very often we get somebody sentenced
without
a PSI, but
yeah.
Not very often.
So that process happens. That's a really important process. The defender-based advocacy that Eric asked about is something that did exist here 20 years ago. It's really it's an alternative to a pre-sentence investigation report in the sense that it's done from the defender's perspective by a not-for-profit agency which does this as a substantial part of their business. And it really becomes either supplement to, complement to, or sometimes flat-out alternative to what probation recommends. So probation might say, you know, housing is unstable, attitude is poor, history is bad, high level of risk, and they may, you know, and that's what they're asked to do. They're not asked to fix those things. They're asked to assess those things. Defender-based advocate might really jump in and see if they can, before sentencing, get some housing secured, get them into mental health, and then put together a comprehensive plan saying either, you know, let's adjourn sentencing and see if we can do this, or whatever. So there's really, they're not conflicting efforts. They're from different perspectives, and they really have different responsibilities, but they can be extremely useful. I found them very useful when I was a defense attorney, and I had about a half a dozen of the defender-based advocacy plans that I brought to court. And in every case, the judge went with them. You know, it's not like either punish them or don't. It's just, you know, choosing between choices. I don't know if you have any comment on that at all.
I haven't read one.
Yeah.
So who's going to be running that program?
This is the Syracuse, what's the name of the organization?
Oh, CCA.
CCA.
Community.
Center for Change, or Alternatives.
Yeah, so they've done it for 25 years. Or
in Onondaga.
Years. Okay, and so they've got a contract to do it here. They've already been involved. I had a case with someone with an old sex offense conviction and now was moved to New York, was now subject to New York Sex Offense Registration Act laws. And the local attorney contracted with them to do a whole bunch of legwork about around the sex offense stuff. And it was actually very effective advocacy. These folks are pretty sharp. The attorney came down and everything, so they had a lot going on.
But they're only funded to do, I think, about 30 a year, is where the cap is.
So what's going to happen? What's going to have to happen is the defense attorney's going to have to say, look, I got a good case, I think, for a DBA. Yeah. Ask to get approved from the judge or from site counsel.
I think assigned counsel.
Assigned counsel. I think.
And then they'll do their alternative pre-sentence investigation report.
I know depending on the case, I've written them before my own sentencing memos.
Right. Sentencing memos can have, so this is kind of a variation on that.
Did you say there was a limit on how many contractors?
By grant.
Yeah, but the county's getting $100,000 each year for 3 years, and it's something.
It's about 30.
It's about 30 cases per year.
What will probably happen is they'll only do 15 in the first year, and they'll do 40 in the second year, and then they'll want 100 of them. It takes a while for it to get started.
But it's also for the local cost of, the office here. I mean, it's not just, they're pretty intense work.
They do. It is. It's good quality work, historically. So those issues are out there. The things that I would say about that is that there's also been flexibility built into the law in recent years, some of it older than others, about interim probation supervision, which is a variation on adjourning sentencing. Right? So historically, probation could only be a sentence of the court. And then a while ago, the law got changed and said you can actually put somebody on probation under certain circumstances prior to sentencing. So that's a complete change in the law. So it's because on interim probation, you're on probation under typically the exact same terms you would be if you were sentenced, but it happens before your sentence.
How's that different from release under supervision?
It's completely different because release under supervision is call once or twice a week or come in once a week. That's it. Don't get arrested and call or come in and go to court when you're supposed to. Interim probation is 4 pages of probation. You are on probation. You're meeting with a probation officer. You're being drug tested as required. You're in treatment. All of the conditions. A sex offender's got a 10-page list of things. They've got the technology requirements and all. So you're actually on probation. You haven't been sentenced. There's a lot of advantages to that because it means that harsher sanctions haven't been imposed, so that's the advantage to the defendant. It's like, well, probation will sometimes suggest this when they've got real doubts about the person being able to be successful in the community, but there's some reason to believe them that they're going to make changes, or there's some reason to test them about whether they're going to make the changes.
Or when you recommend incarceration for someone when they're at 10-10-10, which is like the
highest risk
off the scale of risk, and the court wants to put them on probation.
Right. Yeah. I just say why you might recommend it,
we'll say to the court, we recommend an interim period where the court places the person, they don't sentence, they place the person on this trial period of probation with the exact same conditions that they could get if even if they were sentenced to probation, and then we give them a go for a certain period of time.
It could be any length of time, be 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, up to a year, and then it can now be renewed for a second year. That plays into how judicial diversion works, which we won't talk about today. But one thing to understand about this, if they are on interim probation supervision, they are just awaiting sentencing. The case is otherwise ready for sentencing. So if there's an allegation of substantial violation of all terms of probation, you can just bring them right into court and proceed to sentencing because they're ready for sentencing. So it has that immediacy to it. It has the intensity of the supervision, but it's got the added part that they are still waiting for their day in court. It's not like you've been sentenced today, you got 5 years of probation, You'll never see that judge again unless you screw up. No, this time you're going to see the judge as soon as you screw up, and probation is unlikely to be the outcome for you.
Without doing a BOP or anything.
No, I don't require a BOP or any paperwork at all because it's sentence ready.
It's just a letter to the court.
Yes, it's a notification.
This is how this person.
I mean, I've never had there could be a factual contest if they said that, you know, that did not happen at all.
Yeah.
But it's never been that kind of a thing. It's usually pretty obvious.
Yeah, and sometimes we use it in the plea bargaining as well.
Yeah, right.
So that
you just say, look, give this guy a chance. No, give him a chance. Well, how about interim probation for 3 months? I'll show you he can do it. He's going to be living with me.
How does this differ from a stay of sentence where you're allowed to leave and go to treatment for 9 months? Basically,
yeah, so that's the difference. You could just adjourn sentencing. You could adjourn sentencing under a lot of different circumstances with the consent of the defendant, and the prosecution doesn't really have the right to a speedy sentencing. The defendant does, though. So that would be the old thing. We'd say, you know what, we're going to adjourn sentencing and see how you do. What are you going to be doing? This adds the supervision of probation. So it could be. Sometimes we'll put them under probation instead of the St. Joe's. But sometimes if we've got, it's drug court, it's a difference. We've got, someone needs to have their finger on the case. And so if it's a drug court case, the drug court coordinator could be the one. Rather than putting them under probation, let's send them to St. Joe's first for 6 months, and if they successfully complete that, then we'll put them on interim probation because they don't want to burden probation with monitoring somebody who's out of county.
Right. So if you go out of county, you're not being monitored by probation.
You could basically. Could be, but it's just more work for them.
But normally you're sort of in the hands of the treatment facility.
Yes.
A problem,
but it's still that's most likely done in drug court cases. Because then you've got a coordinator who's got the responsibility to track those out-of-county cases.
So the county still does that?
Yes. Yep. Probation department's very good about doing what they're told to do. That's what they have to do. And they say, please
they know
don't
the
make us do that.
So, in a significant number of cases, probation does a pre-sentence.
I have no idea what the number is. All felons. But a significant number.
Okay.
I just don't know what percentage.
And for a probably smaller percentage, the DBA program may be making a recommendation.
No. No, those would be the same cases.
They would bring a defender-based approach in probation.
Right, but only on the ones where it got approved within that cap.
So yeah, but it's still but it's in the same category. I thought you were saying the other
category. No, where I'm going is, District Attorney's Office also make a sentencing recommendation?
Yes. They rarely do it in writing, though they could. But they have to be heard at sentencing. And they basically, in some sense, the probation department report, while it's not in any way subject to the prosecutor's approval, they have the plea agreement before them, they have the facts before them, and they take the position. And generally, the prosecutor will adopt that. Or if they're doing something different, they'll explain why. Because the probation report carries a lot of weight.
Yeah, there are times they've been using these Farrar conditions and plea memos.
There's a new Supreme Court case which has led to a new procedure where defense counsel are being required to agree to a sentencing recommendation before probation is looked at. That would be a good question to ask the DA, you know, why.
Yeah, there's certain ADAs who use it regularly and some others who don't.
I don't mean to suggest that you're not sharp. It's a complicated issue. The result of it is that the DA can demand in a plea agreement that the defense counsel agree to their sentencing recommendation. So they're going to say, look, a condition of this offer is that you agree to it and you don't argue for anything different than what I say. And so what could happen is they say, look, we'll give you a deal. The deal's 1 year local. You have to agree to it, and you can't ask for anything different. Probation department gets ordered. It comes back, it says strict probation, and everybody's locked in. They can't argue it. And now, I can order it, and I have deviated from it, but it's all of a sudden being used a lot, and I think there's a fair question to ask why.
Yeah, because they also use
handcuffs. Because I understand correctly that it's then relatively unusual for the district attorney's office to make a sentencing recommendation that different from the probation?
Yeah, it's unusual.
And the other thing with Farrar, though, is they've been using it to handcuff the judges because then they have the right to pull the offer, which you know.
You mean if the judge is committed to it?
No, if the judge, like, so I've been in city court with Judge Rossiter, and on a Farrar plea, it was something that was charged, or could have been charged as a felony, and then depending on the ADA has it, she's said on the record before once that I can't do anything other, because it's a Farrar condition, for a Farrar plea, because had she deviated from it, the DA would have just pulled the offer right then and there.
Yeah.
And that's, I know that's, they do that from, certain ADAs do that from time to time. Not all of them are doing it, just a couple.
I mean, so this is, again, the tension between a judge being willing to show command or not. So if I've got a serious felony case, we're trying to resolve it, and the offer's 10 years, and the defendant is not interested in going away for 10 years, we come in and start negotiating. We'll sometimes say, you know, well, look, the DA said, look, I'll offer 7 years if you'll commit to that, judge, you know, because they don't want to come in and say, look, we'll knock it down a notch from, you know, robbery to attempted robbery, where now the judge has way more discretion, come in and ask for 7 and we give him 3. So it's a useful tool for plea bargaining purposes. I'll say, look, yeah, I'll do that. I'll commit to 7 if the defendant will sign on to that, and then we're all in agreement. But it can also be used to undermine, especially when you, I can't imagine why you have Farrar conditions in misdemeanor pleas. I think that's really.
I've had it happen to me twice.
I'm sure that's a good thing. So anyway, we don't want to get sidetracked too much, but those are some of the kind of the nuances of that.
I don't want to belabor this too much, but where I was trying to go is to get a sense of what extent is the sentencing process influenced by in-house policies in the DA's office, and is that something that we want to learn more about? And
I think it's a fair question. I think it's an appropriate question. I don't think that this DA's office has. I think they're generally pretty favorable in the sense of favoring alternatives, recognizing the realities of the lay of the land. I mean, they'll come in routinely saying we support diversion or recommending drug court. So you're not going to, not like you might find another county where you're dealing with really harsh recommendations, I think it's a fair question to say in what cases do you have policies, what kind of guidelines do you have, where do they apply. I think it's just good information for this community to have. But I mean, Gwen certainly is. I mean, I think if Gwen had her preference, she would be far more liberal in her plea and sentencing, which would be interesting to hear, because she's actually doing a lot of studying on it. She's going to a conference on it. She's really looking at what better alternatives are out there. I mean, what is the model in Sweden? But, you know, a lot of that, unfortunately, those models include prisons and alternatives to prisons that don't exist.
Yeah.
You know, so it's hard to have one piece of that and say, you know what, rather than 6 years for those, we're going to recommend 3 years.
So, send them to Sweden.
You know,
be cheaper.
Can people just think of other questions you have about pleas, about trials, about people being held or being released? I can tell you that it's a big hassle to have defendants in custody for trials. Trial started today in county court. A defendant is shackled at the ankles, and there's got to be all sorts of efforts made to minimize the jury's view of the defendant in shackles. But the reality is, so they dress in plain clothes, they dress in street clothes, but there's two sheriff's deputies sitting next to them.
Right.
And defendant has to get up to be able to move around, and so they shuffle, so you can't hide it. We did finally get black curtains around the table so the jury's not looking at the defendant's shackles all day long, which is one thing that's been problematic in the past.
Who determines that the defendant is shackled?
I have the authority to order them to be unshackled. The policy, generally I talk it over with court security. So, and where I've gone with this is that I'm not, for anybody who's incarcerated, as a general rule, having their ankles shackled seems to me to be the minimally intrusive level. I mean, I don't want their hands shackled, although it could happen, you know, with the wrong person. But given the potential for mischief of various kinds, we've gone with that. That's my own personal policy. I do have your authority to tell them to take off those shackles. The better thing to do would be to, another important option would be to look at what are the release possibilities pending trial. And there are circumstances where electronic monitoring or something else as a condition of release solves a whole lot of those problems. Makes it a lot easier to confer with the attorney to do the investigation, participate in the trial. It takes all those issues, you know, out of there.
But is that something that Bernadette or probation makes recommendations on?
Well, no, because you would have made those pretrial decisions quite a bit earlier.
Right.
But I think attorneys, defense attorneys, again, it might be a training issue for defense attorneys to make sure they're renewing the request to review their status pending trial. Because by that point, you might have made that decision 4 months ago, 6 months ago, and now they're coming up to trial, and you know, actually, I mean, in some cases, I mean, I have lowered bail when I've watched cases deteriorate in the quality of the proof. You know, so I'm getting close to trial, and I'm getting to know the case better and better, and I know this is a tough one for them. I'm going to lower the bail, because I just don't, because one of the conditions, one of the rationale, one of the legal areas that I can consider is the strength of the people's case. So if they got a rock-solid case, I can give them a rock-solid bail. The case is crap. I may lower the bail. They get posted. It's a lot easier for everybody else. If they get acquitted, they get acquitted. If they get convicted, away they go. We never had a problem with that, but it doesn't mean that we won't. I mean, there's a lot of judgment in these things.
Is there a differential between misdemeanor and felony charges coming to trial shackled? I mean, who makes the presumption
that people should be shackled? There's not very often that the misdemeanor cases in top village courts that there's still in custody. I don't know.
Well, it's the policy of the Sheriff's Department when they do a transport to use shackles.
That's right.
And,
right.
And once they arrive at whatever court, then they can shackle or unshackle.
Yeah, they become
as the court's policy.
Yes, I think that's the way it is. So I don't know what happens with the town and village courts. I just didn't really answer that question.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, Bernadette's pretrial release report, so we do an initial report at the very first time you go to jail. But lots of times, Judge, and even when the case gets transferred to county court, you'll ask for an updated report, and we can go back in and re-interview the person.
That would be another good training point for defense attorneys to ask for that.
Anything that's changed, or if there's a household that would take them in, or if there's someone who can vouch.
This thing's could have changed a lot, you know, especially because Bernadette's doing very fast reporting, and you know, a month later, 2 weeks later, she might have a very different report to write.
Yeah, because sometimes I know some of the defendants, they may have some connections here, like say they're out of town, and they just haven't had a chance to talk to the friends or whoever to see if they'd be able to stay with them while, you know, pending trial. And some folks can't make that decision right away, even if you contact them, because they're like,
or we can't reach them.
Right.
And I've asked Bernadette to keep her eye on the board to see who's still in there a couple weeks, so that she can reconnect with that person to see if anything has changed.
Yeah.
On the issue of bail, I don't know how it changes over time with OIR. It's possible, for example, that just say the current OIR rules, that as the case got close to trial, maybe somebody had been holding on $10,000 bail, that if defense attorney was in contact with OIR and OIR said, look, this is a bailable person, if you can get him to $2,500, or if you can get someone to match $2,500, you know, we'll get the judge down to $5,000. But, you know, I might reduce to $2,500, knowing OIR is going to free him just before trial because of all those issues. I mean, it's clearly an infringement of rights to be incarcerated at the time of trial, and it does have real impact. So it would be part of the balance.
We do revisit those, you know.
OIR
does revisit them, and frequently there are a few cases that we'll track specifically because the bail seemed excessive to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so we'll talk to the defense attorney pretty regularly to figure out, like, has it been reduced?
Yeah,
and then I know we do that about six or seven times a year, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there's times, too. Like, one thing we probably could do is come to the county court more when we get one of these excessive bails.
Take it from the... Yeah.
Because...
That's where the excessive bails come from, is from the town courts.
Yeah, and there are definitely times when we could probably do that more often.
Well, I would agree that's another training issue that the standard for those is abuse of discretion, but it's certainly possible to find the abuse of discretion in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain cases where you know you're going to resolve it very quickly. Like if you're within 2 weeks of the pretrial, and depending on who you're working with, you might be able to come to some resolution that fast. But after that, you know, if you're waiting another month for, you can't wait another month for a pretrial or anything. Right. I'm missing here. It's just not right.
So while we're on that topic, though, I mean, I know Joe's very sensitive to this, and OER has been very public about this, but there is no question that the funding, the money in the OER fund, the rules that they have on what bails they will make, and the staffing levels they have are directly related to our jail population. If you doubled all of that, you would have a far bigger bang for your buck than you would for the price of that. And there's lots of policy considerations there, but I don't think anybody could argue with that statement.
The only thing I will say is that the state has passed legislation now about charitable bail organizations.
Really?
Last year. Whoa. It went into effect January of this year. And we're not... We had to get fingerprinted, licensed bail agents, Val and I, and go through all this, pay a $1,000 fee. But they've also limited the amount of bail that charitable fund organizations can post to 2,000.
So that, and you are in that category?
Yeah.
You are a charitable.
We are 501c3.
Yeah, yeah.
But what we do is we bail still the 2,500. And we told the guy that came down here, because we asked for a $500 copay, so it's only a $2,000 bail. And we're just saying, you know, and they haven't said they haven't taken that ability away yet.
Yeah.
We can't increase our bail to 5,000.
Well, I guess my request would be that we ask you to come to us with, you know, what currently impairs, you know, besides the law, which is the law,
right,
what impairs your ability to bail more people? I'm making it up. I've been working with OEA for a long time, and I know you've been whittled away and whittled away and whittled away. But you know, there might be a point where it would be like double the bail fund and double your staff, but it might be like one more of this and 5,000 more of this would probably make us the most efficient we could be. So I'd be interested in you thinking about that and presenting that to us.
Can you answer that off the top of your head? That if you had more resources, would you be able to bail more people?
If I had more staff, I could bail more people. The county, the legislature has been really good when I've come to them for more money for the bail fund.
You've got money in the bail fund, but you don't have people with which to process.
To a degree. When we had 3 client service workers, we did 72 or 73 bails back 3 years ago, 4 years ago now. And last year we did 62. We're down to 2 client service workers. So, I mean, there is a correlation just in the number of bails, just because it isn't just writing a check. I mean, as you know, it's the whole follow-up and contact. So, you know, that's the correlation. But with the cap and the law, there is, I mean, to be honest about this, there's going to be a limit of, you know, where we're going to bail. We have some judges, not...
They know the limit.
They know the limit. So we see the 3,000, and that's for a good reason. That gives us, it says, okay, this is a drug court thing. You know, we call probation about a lot of these things. We're now starting to call a veterans person who's trying to get people into treatment so that we can figure out, like, what else is going on in this person's life. But there are particularly town justices who know that OAR's limit's 2,500, and we'll see a $5,000 bail come through on something that is an abuse of authority, abuse of discretion.
So that would be just another area that we should... I would like to hear a specific proposal from you about. I mean, it's just a piece of the puzzle, but it's an important piece.
Could you say the limit was 25,000?
2,500.
I mean, 2,500.
It's actually 2,000 is the state limit.
Oh.
OAR's limit is 2,500 because of the way we're interpreting the law.
What they're doing is they get 500 from somewhere else.
Okay,
a family member will come up with that 500.
So that we're only executing a $2,000 bail amount.
Right.
But they didn't understand charitable bail at all. We're being supervised now by the Division of Financial Services.
Really?
Yeah, and they had no idea. They came to meet with us a couple weeks ago because we refused to go to Albany, because we said, you know, you've got a huge department, and we're three people, we'll have to close our office. So they finally came with Barbara Lipton's intervention to us. And they asked, like, well, how much profit do you make on this? What's your profit margin? It was like, this was the Division of Financial Services. They've never dealt with...
A budget office or something?
They deal with, like, bail bondsmen. They deal with people like...
They regulate bondsmen.
They regulate bondsmen, and so they were asking us... Yes, the old insurance department.
Who are they under? Division of Financial Services? It's
a
department.
It's standalone. And they do a
standalone.
Lot of...
Standalone, it's its own department. It used to be the insurance division, maybe some other things. They combined it into a single department.
And then they reached out to do the charitable thing, and they have no idea how... They don't understand what it means that we're a 501c3. When I explain that there isn't, like... I'll show you a profit-loss report, but it doesn't...
The profit loss.
There's no profit here. It's all loss.
You know, 10% of every bail that we do. I mean, what are they thinking?
Yeah. So, and there's a limit of what, you know, on a $100,000 bail, individual professional bondsmen can only charge like up to 10%.
So to finish the original idea, so we get a plea, also we have trial. At the end of trial, if there's a conviction, then there's going to be the order for the pre-sentence investigation again in most cases. And there's really not much to be done during that time period. And then the issues really come in sentencing. And that's, again, training and awareness. Even the training for the judges, you know, look, if you're conflicted about whether or not this is a jail case or not, you have a variety of tools. You can simply say, folks, I'm going to adjourn, you know, the probation report comes in and it says, did not get the alcohol and drug, didn't go to the alcohol and drug counsel as they were supposed to. We have no report to give you. And it might be the single biggest issue in the case. The judge can say, look, we're going to adjourn sentencing for 60 days. If you're fully engaged in treatment at that time, consider options. If you're not engaged in treatment, I don't have a report, fine. I'm going to go along with the recommendation. I mean, so I think most judges do that, but I think it's worth having those conversations periodically just to help them make sure they know that they have various tools that they have. And interim probation, any level, right? B or A misdemeanor, you could use it. You could use it there, too.
And about the no PSI for 6 months or less, actually, New York State has a bifurcated law about that, because in New York City, it's a year or less. And
they
got their own special law passed down there just to address the New York City deluge of...
So they can get up to a year without any...
Without a PSI. So... Mm-hmm. I think the movement is going to be, but that applies to the whole state, but why should New York City get that? I think I'm the only director in the state who is against that. I just feel like if you're going to take away someone's liberty, they deserve to have a PSI written so the court has all the facts before them. But all the other directors were for it, but I was the only one.
Yeah, it saves them work. You know, it's losing sight of the principle again.
Yeah,
it saves
exactly.
them work.
Yeah, it saves work, but I don't think it's the right thing to do.
So. Can I ask a question about the report? So we've got one person going to death who does this before. That's pre-trial release. Okay, but sentencing reports.
We
write the sentencing report. What's the timeline of that? Did I hear 4, 5, 6 weeks?
4 weeks for someone who's incarcerated, 5 weeks if they're not.
And is that timeline because of the person power we put behind it, or it just takes that long to do kind of the legwork to put together?
There's a lot of legwork. You have to get you have to interview the person. You have to do your collateral contacts. You have to actually review the rap sheet, actually write the report.
Verify a bunch of records.
What's that?
Verify a bunch of records.
Verify records. There's a lot that goes into it. It probably takes 8 hours, just even in my opinion, to write the report, to actually sit down and between your interview and writing the report, and just it's like a full day. But
they're
then
really
you've got
long.
All this other stuff you've got to do.
So they're really long.
They're long.
They're excellent. They're excellent.
Yeah. Maybe I'm putting words into his mouth, but I think the question is, suppose you had another probation officer available for that responsibility.
Five.
Would that
be? Yeah, you need...
In other words, would more personnel shorten the average time? Or is it just, this is as long as it takes?
No, it's, you know, I had one probation officer dedicated to just writing PSIs, and she was doing about 20 a month. And even with that, it still took that time frame. I mean, it's workload. It's workload.
My opinion would be that the 4 or 5 weeks is remarkably fast, especially compared to other places. Mm-hmm. When we have to go out of county, they're asking for 2 or 3 months, minimum, all the time.
We have held to that 4 and 5 weeks.
The only place where a complaint that I have, and I don't think it's real, I mean, it's just a complaint, I don't think we can address it, is that there are prison-ready cases where the agreement is prison, and we just get them off of our dime as soon as possible. And we'll occasionally call up and, you know, offer a probation officer lunch, and they'll get it done in 3 weeks. So if you had a dedicated person to do that, you know, maybe they would be the high priority PSI person. But in general, I would say it's a very efficient system. And that the 4 or 5 weeks is what you need anyhow, especially after trial. You know, that there are sometimes applications that have to be made. There's ramifications that people have to get ready to do whatever's going to happen to them. The defender-based advocacy would be done during that time period. In fact, they would likely ask for an extension. So I have no complaint about that time.
She would be doing it. You ideally want that way up front.
Yeah, I think it's a very efficient and a good rhythm from a legal perspective, that 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And we have expedited.
And they do expedite them.
Some, you know, the court.
But there's a limit to it, you know.
Or the jail calls us and says, well, can you expedite the PSI on this person because they're causing problems up here and we just want to get them out of here or whatever. We'll do that. Eric?
Okay. I guess the case I'm imagining, and I don't know if this ever happens or happens infrequently or what, but I'm imagining someone who may spend a fairly lengthy period of time in jail awaiting trial. And if they then went in for sentencing today, they'd probably get sentenced to time served. Or they can wait 4 weeks for a pre-sentence investigation and then get sentenced to time served.
Yeah, it doesn't usually happen that way. If everybody's on the same page, like for example, if there's going to be a six-five split is a fairly normal sentence in county court, 6 months of jail with 5 years of probation. The person's already been held for 3 months. On 6 months, to only deserve 4 months. If they've been held 3 months, at the time of the plea, I may just say, look, or 3.5, I say, you know what, I'm going to release them now. If they stay out of trouble, then they're not going to have to serve that last 2 or 3 weeks. If everybody has a basic idea of how much time they're going to serve, at the time of the plea, or even at the time of conviction after trial, if they have a basic idea of what the sentence is going to be, we don't hold them. We generally release them. Now, the judge doesn't have to. I mean, it's the same. A simpler way to think about it is it's a violation. A violation is only punishable up to 15 days, which means you serve 10. Well, I could arraign one tonight, hold him on bail, schedule him to come back in a week. He's still in jail, and he says he wants a trial. I schedule the trial for a week after that. Well, there he's got 14 days in, where maximum sentence is 10. It's not fair. There's really not much anybody can do about it. I mean, they could bring an article, I mean, or a Habe or whatever, but I think people are pretty sensitive about that, the excessive jail. But judges, if they do it, they could be doing it intentionally. Like, yeah, this guy's going to spend every day in jail that I think that they should, which isn't necessarily good. But the pre-sentence report, it is not, I don't think, a significant factor in that. The length of time for the report is not as significant.
Joe?
It's
dealing with this. But if someone is convicted of a felony, while you're awaiting that report, do they go back to jail?
It's really a fresh look at it once again. There will often be, I mean, if someone's been in the community and they're convicted of a significant crime after trial, the DA is going to make an immediate request for review of the release status. And in some cases, they're remanded. In some cases, bail is set. Sometimes they walk right back out the door. With the plea, it's usually negotiated. It's usually said in the plea agreement that the current status will continue, so that if they're out on bail or out on a release of supervision, they stay out. Every once in a while, the difference would be somebody who's in jail who's going to get out. I get nervous about those, and I say this out loud to them. You do not want to enter a guilty plea to get out of jail today. That's a bad motivation, but it happens.
I was just going to say, sometimes if the defendant knows they're going to be sentenced to some jail time, the defense attorney will say, get started now. And get
it does happen, and then at the time of the plea, or even we can accommodate it. At any time, if you've got a charge pending against you, you can come into court and say, I want to start time now, and just revoke your release status and put you in.
Yeah.
So some people. You have that flexibility. It happens once in a while.
It happens. Yeah. There's times
when I had a sex offender today who I think wanted to get locked up because he feels out of control. I mean, he was facing getting locked up. I said, we're going to lock you up. I said, kind of, thank you. Before I didn't make things worse. And that's kind of defense attorney's thing. It's like, you know what? We got three pending felonies out there. Judge, please remand them so we don't have four.
Yeah.
Well, that's a real public safety issue.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, why are they out there in the first place?
But sometimes with these folks who are abusing, you know,
with drugs.
Drugs or they... they'll immediately offend once you let them walk out the door. And it's not... usually really low-level stuff, but that effect, if they're in there for, you know, if it's a felony case they're facing, it's going to affect the sentencing. And,
sure.
And some of the folks recognize it, and they'll want to be held, others won't. And there, a lot of them, I think, some of them are the borderline cases where, you know, the person knows to be in treatment, but then you, it's just a judgment call with them, especially if you know the defendant.
So we get to sentencing. And then we've got a half hour, so do we want to get into after the sentence is served?
I think we could be more productive looking at what we have before us and start to have some categories.
Take the half hour and start looking at
it. You know, the after the sentence is served stuff is long term.
Mm-hmm. Real long term, yeah.
They actually only, the one quick thing that we were talking about was actually getting some manpower behind a real re-entry position, but that's probably what we'll talk about.
There's one other, I guess one other thing where I've seen a couple of times, I've heard of, where if someone hasn't, if they're in a town court and they haven't paid the fine.
It's happened today, as a matter of fact.
Some of the judges are putting people in jail for not...
And that's a real problem. You can't do it without a hearing.
Right.
You have to make factual findings, and that's, again, an area that should be cautioned in, because you can effectively throw out the bench.
Well, that's good to know.
Debtor's prison.
Because I have someone today
because they're not
who was,
paying a fine?
He didn't pay a fine. This is a frequent occurrence in certain town courts. But someone didn't pay a fine. They were put in jail, picked up on bench warrant. A $400 bail for a $355 fine. We bailed them. This justice will probably forfeit the bail to pay the fine.
Oh.
We have to then go back. We write to him, CC Jonathan Wood.
Yeah, we told him we couldn't do that.
But it still happens. And to say that what this is an illegal or a misappropriation of county dollars, please return this bail to OAR.
Well, I wrote that letter to the Judicial Conduct Commission.
It's a good advice.
I was
going
to say, you want to be coming in and sitting down and talking.
Well, I might be facing one of those soon. Because
Don't write the letter about me.
No, but I might have one of these situations soon where he's already served, it was in DWAI, he's already served the 15 days, still can't come up with the fine money, and he was brought in front of the court today and to get, you know, admonished. But I know this, you know, probably in 2 months try to...
Yeah, the statute's very clear. We try to collect DWI fines periodically. We try to make a big deal out of it. We notice people, we tell them to come in, we offer them a variety of options to say, I can't pay. I'm financially unable to pay. They have to be assigned an attorney, and there has to be hearing held. And the judge has to make very specific findings. We don't do debtor's prison. There has to be a finding of willful intention not to pay the fine, ability to pay the fine, a failure to pay the fine. The judge has the all sorts of authority to set the fine aside or to change the terms of that.
Yep.
But it's not something you want to fool around with, because that is a real abuse of power.
Is that one of the things where you had said, like, for
judicial conduct,
the parent not paying, you know, the child support stuff. It's like sometimes you sanction them to jail because that's the only option we have. Is that one of those times like this where it's like, what would you like to have?
No, that's completely different.
I mean, I know they're two different things, but the concept of, is this one of those things where if you had like a crew or something?
No,
or something
I think that this is a small problem with a certain specific people that need an education.
You should come in.
I don't think it's a system issue at all.
Yeah.
It would be a bad habit if we start getting into it.
Yeah. I mean, I thought we nipped that in the bud before. I didn't know it was
going to just happened again today.
Was that the first time since we wrote that letter?
No, it's happened about 6-7 times since we wrote that letter.
It's been about
my wife is proud.
I know specifically recently.
How often is education? How often is the cost of the assigned counsel greater than the amount of the fine?
I don't know because I don't get the assigned counsel records, but I can estimate that certainly the cost of keeping him in jail is more than the cost of the fine.
Men's room,
right there.
Oh. Boys room.
I want to get out of here by 7, right? Like 10 minutes.
If we go 15 more minutes, I'll be.
So what can counsel do in that situation? We're talking about trying to keep people out of jail. Is someone sending them to jail illegally? It sounds so weird.
Yeah, what's defense counsel?
We'd have to appeal to county.
Yeah, and what we do is we try to bail them as soon as they come across. When they come across that they were picked up on a bench warrant, we interview them and talk to them. They say, yeah, I didn't pay a $355 fine. We ask, are you employed? Da, 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 da. You know, why didn't you pay it? We go through the whole thing, and then we usually bail them because they're going to lose their job if they are employed. It's a huge expense.
Yeah.
And you guys have to come to county too.
Right, besides just appearing in the town or village court first, then you have to come write your motion, then you appear in county, and then, you know, usually it would be over then, but you're still talking a couple hours. And especially if they're picked up on a warrant, say they're picked up at 2 in the morning, so you could
have... Are there multiple judges that are doing this?
Predominantly one, but there's two others that have done it on occasion that I know of.
Yeah, so it's probably no more than 5.
No, you can't do
that.
No, but we would do the letter, and the minute we sent that letter, they stopped because
I think what's next is the letter to judicial conduct is what's next.
Yeah, the thing is, the attorneys are kind of
send a copy
reluctant to get involved in that because they have to practice.
Because they have to practice in front.
Right.
But we...
most of them don't believe in using the electoral system to solve problems like I do.
Right. Well, so what do you do then? You take it to county.
Today.
You make an appeal.
How do you get them out?
I haven't had to do it yet.
Anyway. You just sent a letter from OAR saying you're misappropriating county dollars.
Make a motion to county.
We've gotten it back eventually.
And then did they do it again?
Yeah. He knows it's a misappropriation of county dollars.
It's just a matter of, like, the attorney time behind it is probably usually, depending on the fine, I mean, probably roughly equal. The only ones that I think would be less would be if someone's maxed on a DWI fine.
Sometimes the fines are so small, I wish I could just have a slush fund to go pay them, to get them out of, you know, to pay, like, we've had people in there for less than $100 fine.
Well, there was one guy I know, I don't know if they've even caught him yet, actually, out of the one court I'm thinking of, it was a $50 DNA fee he didn't pay.
DNA?
When you're convicted of pretty much every misdemeanor now, there's a $50 DNA collection fee. So I know of one letter I got on a client who didn't pay that fee. He lives out of county, but the judge issued a warrant for it. I don't know if he's ever been picked up on it yet. Probably had. It's been like a year. I don't think he's been picked up on it. But when he's picked up, if he's picked up on something else, they'll catch the warrant system, and then he'll be brought back up here. And it's over $50.
Even more expensive.
Over $50.
That's probably up to 10 letters to get in here and pay that, right?
Yeah, but I mean, really,
not just issue of pensions. Mm-hmm. They're contacting us like, come on, you've got to come in here.
But it's somebody who
is unable to pay.
It's just unable. They're not going to be able to pay. I mean, the judge has seen him like twice. should know.
So why don't they work it off, and instead of getting paid the money?
Because the state wants the money.
Yeah, some of this, that's a state fee.
It's a state fee.
Goes
to the state coffers.
So is there a state policy that's influencing the judge?
Why don't we have them work?
There's a bunch of laws that set mandatory fines.
Do the DNA.
Right.
And they even have to pay that if their DNA was connected previously at a collected in another case. That's just.
I think that's wrong.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
No, but my question is, in terms of how aggressively the judge
collects, they charge a fee every time. Like if you say we're convicted.
Well, like how do you get blood from the state? That's the question.
Yeah, you don't.
So they only collect it once and they charge you the fee each time?
Yeah, they'll charge the fee each time.
So they charge you a fee when they don't
collect it. And then you just pass it through. So we spend county money to collect the state fee.
That goes to the state.
Right. And all these lines. It's all unfunded budget.
They don't do it.
We don't charge.
We
don't
charge.
The money goes to the state. We collect.
Have the money goes to the state.
You're a guru on that one.
All right, do we have anything more
this
on that?
This is bad for my blood
pressure. On the process, walking through the process, are we pretty much done with that?
Yeah.
Which all process? Right.
Walking through the process, what we just did.
The sentence.
From the plea or trial.
Like I said before, I'd be interested in hearing about the process from the DA's point of view.
I would also. I will make those requests again.
And let me just say, I personally would very much prefer to hear from the DA than from an assistant DA.
Like I said, the request will be made again. And I'll try to schedule. I don't know about Monday. I don't think she'll come on Monday. Our next meeting is Monday, back over there. And we will.
We know where she works. We can just go across the street and drag her out of the courthouse.
We can hold a meeting in Gwen's office.
Maybe some of us know where she lives.
All right. Okay.
I just want to distribute.
Yeah. Let's look at this and then look at the notes that I passed out from the input night, the public input night, and then Monday we will start seriously crunching and looking at everything we've heard for suggestions.
And this is a real rough and dirty, taking the notes that I had from the public input meeting and trying to break them down by issue area, recommendations that the public made. It's only about that one meeting. It's not about everything else we've done.
I assume that our own suggestions and ideas need to be incorporated into that process somehow, too.
Absolutely need to be, but I didn't have time today to do it. I just went right from the notes. But I thought it might give us a framework to start doing a chart of all the different ideas, and then I've got a line that's mainly unfilled that's fiscal impact.
Okay. I think.
What is this stuff for?
Everybody get a copy from Deb.
I got.
Anyway.
Put that one from Deb. Everybody got it.
Conference calls.
All right, and
we could look at
so
this.
So I think we at least need to figure out how are we going to break it out. Stuff we can do now, stuff that's more long term, or break it out by flavor.
I think first what we need to do is do what Eric said, which is all the things that have been brought up today. This is just from that one meeting. So I think what we need to do is revisit all the meetings we've had, the various points of that have been mentioned about where there might be an alternative or intervention, and incorporate it into one big chart, and then have another column that could be time frame. Can it be done immediately? Can it be done within 2 years, 3 years, you know, and start to look at that. But we don't have anything that's comprehensive yet.
Right. This is from the public meeting. We've got
a lot of ideas that are captured here.
A lot of ideas that have come up during our meetings. And we need to start listing that stuff.
It might be a good idea if we can take our master, our still hypothetical master list of ideas, carve it into 3 or 5 or 7 chunks, and have a subcommittee for each chunk, and then bring it back together rather than try and be brainstorming about all of it with this many people around the table.
I think we need to see what we got, and then decide.
And then decide how to work it, because I also think that some of the area, if we do it by area, that we don't have the expertise at this table for some of those areas. Housing, I mean, for instance,
right.
You know, there are just a couple that jump out that there's a lot of expertise here, but not necessarily on public funding streams for housing or... But first we need to see, I think, a chart of, like, what are all the things?
All the things that we've talked about.
What's the end product for all that work? I
mean, recommendations to the legislature or to the county administrator. First, and then to the legislature. But to the county administrator first. Yeah, public safety. Because some things may have fiscal year 2015 implications, so the suit, you know, we're due out in August.
Joe?
No, I agree. And I also want, I think beyond just listing what has been said in these meetings by the public, what you picked up in these walkthroughs of the process, there's a lot of smart people around this table who have thoughts themselves on, geez, if I have more money, what else can we do?
Right.
And that kind of blue sky conversation ought to happen, too, as you're going through the whiteboard exercise or whatever you do, just to get a full inventory of what the possibilities are, not to feel restricted by what you've heard or what jumped off the poster boards and the walkthroughs. So what do you think? You live it every day. What are your ideas on what we should put in that long list? Do we then whittle down the things that make the most sense?
We did that at CJATI, but I think we need to revisit that. And some pretty good ideas came out of that. But I think we need to... We didn't have a minute taker. I mean, I put down stuff in shorthand. I'll try and find what I can find, but we don't have minutes
for the public meeting?
No, the CJATI.
But I think it's important for this group, too, to do what Joe said. I just, like,
right.
In the best of worlds, where can we make an impact within our agencies or groups or whatever to reduce the population in the jail?
Training on how to commit burglaries effectively without getting caught.
We offer that on
That's
Friday nights.
Oh.
In service.
All right, let's anybody have anything else earth-shattering they want to do tonight? I would move that we are at a good stopping point, and let's pick this up on Monday night.
Thank you, Susie.
Woo-hoo. Thank you.